People of Note on Fine Music Radio is proudly brought to you each week at this time by Peter Turin Productions. This is Rodney Trudgeon welcoming you to this week's edition of People of Note, right here on Fine Music Radio. I'm excited to introduce you to my guest today. It's Not How It Looks is the 27th annual collection from South Africa's legendary cartoonist Zapiro, and it's set to be yet another bestseller as his cartoons brilliantly capture the craziness of yet another wild year here in South Africa and indeed the world. Now, Zapiro is Jonathan Shapiro, born here in Cape Town, and who went to study architecture at UCT. There was conscription, activism, detention, and a Fulbright scholarship to New York before establishing himself as South Africa's best-known cartoonist. I've always been collecting these annual books, your annual collection. Jonathan, welcome.
Thank you.
Mr. Zapiro. Actually, as we came in here, you spoke about where the name Zapiro came from. Because, I mean, I don't know whether to call you Zapiro or Jonathan, so I'm going to do both.
You're welcome to call me whatever you like. That's fine. I went to Rondebosch Boys Preparatory School and then the high school when I arrived in the old Standard 6, Grade 8. There was a matric sort of school hero called Martin Shapiro, but spelt a different way. Actually, a very nice way, very kind of little, had pizzazz in it. It was S-Z-A-P-I-R-O. I thought it was Hungarian, but it turns out it was the Polish spelling. Okay. There are various spellings of Shapiro, but I think that's the nicest one. And the guys in my year called me Zap because they thought I was his brother. And that became my nickname. And I really liked it. And I was also very impressed by this guy, Martin, who was, you know, he was nice to the younger kids, which is unusual. And he was, a prefect, and he was good at sport, a brilliant academic. He was just an all-around nice guy. Unfortunately, he died in a mountaineering accident a couple of years after leaving school.
Oh, my goodness.
So my nickname continued. And I always remembered him. And then when I started doing cartoons, when I was studying architecture, I was much more interested in doing cartoons and always wanted to be a cartoonist than I was in architecture. And I signed my drawings Zap. And I got into some trouble immediately with the...
I'm sure.
I caricatured the head of the school, showed a bit of a dichotomy in his personality or character or things that he was doing. And he took it quite badly, and I really realized that this is really somewhere I should go. So I tried to leave architecture and go and study graphics in order to become a cartoonist. The army conscripted me, and it's all connected with the name because I was still signing these drawings Zap. Mm-hmm. And then so I'm sort of jumping ahead now, but now when I'm already politically involved in 1984, I was drawing a drawing of a policeman shooting dead somebody where they'd been shooting people in the Eastern Cape and elsewhere. And it was my then girlfriend who became my wife later. She said to me, "That looks a little bit flippant for that drawing." And I said, "Yeah, maybe it does." Sort of California surfboard Zap. So I thought, well, let me try and work the rest of my name in, which I did. I spent the afternoon figuring that out, and it sort of took off. And the weekend before last, I did a sort of a reminiscence. That year at my school, the 1972 matrix, they flew his sister, the sister of Martin Shapiro, from New Zealand. And they had a get-together, a reunion, and they asked me to come and speak. And I told that story, which she had heard via friends, and that I'd been telling this on the radio. And it was a very moving
evening. Lovely story.
Yeah.
And there I was thinking it was just a frivolous affectation that you called yourself Zapiro. But what a lovely contact. What a lovely connection.
Yeah.
And now everyone knows you as Zapiro. And here you are with your 27th annual book. And these annual books have been doing well, haven't they? I should think that it's quite a good income for you because people love them. The ideal Christmas present.
It's been a sort of a secondary income for years and years. Mm-hmm. And I think partly because I was able to co-publish So that means that, you know, it's a popular genre. I mean, I always loved the Giles books.
Yes,
when I was growing
up. I loved them.
Yeah, my mom was someone who was born in Germany, but then became very English.
Yes.
And then moved to South Africa later. She also became a very well-known activist, but she always had the Giles books lying around. And I studied these things as a child. I absolutely loved them, as many people did, but I really took to them. And I did wonder, would I ever be able to do something like this? And, you know, all those years later,
here you are.
It happened. And it's great that people give them for sort of Christmas presents, yes. Hanukkah presents, or
all
just whatever
things.
Presents.
Birthdays. Has Giles stopped? He has stopped, hasn't he?
Giles died many
did
years
he die?
Ago.
Okay.
I've actually got his first book that he did, the 1946 one, which has got some much darker stuff. It was, you know, things that he did during the war. But he was very brilliant, always a cartoonist who kind of stuck up for the common person.
Yes, the man in the street, the worker.
Yes, and he was well left of his newspaper, the Daily Express, that he worked for.
Mm-hmm.
But not hard in his, after those first war cartoons, they were kind of almost soft satire, but beautiful and
yes.
And very influential.
Even in those early books of his, like the first one you got, had he developed that family with grandma and auntie?
Or
did they come later?
I don't think they're in the first book.
Oh, okay.
I don't think so. I must go back and check. It's something I'm embarrassed to say I can't remember.
No,
but I think that happened in the next few years.
Okay.
Yeah.
Zapiro, yeah. Jonathan. I would like you now to choose your first piece of music. And Eddie Harris with Les McCann. Tell me about this and why you've chosen it.
When I was a teenager, I was possibly a little out of sync with my peers. I was much more interested in jazz than I was in sort of the popular music. I later developed a much wider spread of musical tastes, but that jazz was my thing. And by the time I got to university, I had a friend who was studying saxophone, and we were avid jazz fans. And this sort of jazz funk, Eddie Harris plays the saxophone, but he sings as well. And then this guy, Les McCann, brilliant pianist. And this was a song that we played. It's got such a vibe. And also many, many years later, when I was studying in New York, and the cartoonist Derek Bauer, the late Derek Bauer, who was a brilliant graphic cartoonist, the best graphic cartoonist this country's ever produced. I mean, his sheer ability.
Mm.
But he came to visit in New York when I was studying there, and I looked up, like, where could I find some nice jazz? And there at the Village Gate was Eddie Harris and Les McCann. And they played this song, and it was so it was a kind of a spectacular evening for me in all around. Thank you.
love, I'm hanging on before it shuts up. Possession is the motivation that is hanging up the goddamn nation. Looks like we always end up in a rut. Everybody now trying to make it real compared to what. Children are killing folks. Poor dumb rednecks rolling along. Tired old ladies kissing dogs. I hate the human love of that stinking mud. I can't use it. Trying to make it real compared to what. Come on, baby. What it's for. Nobody gives us a rhyme or reason. Half a one doubt, they call it treason. We're chicken feathers all the way out wonder. God damn it, I'm trying to make it real compared to what.
Eddie Harris there with Les McCann, and that was called Compared to What, and it was the first music choice of my guest on this week's edition of People of Note here on Fine Music Radio, Jonathan Shapiro. But we're calling him Zapiro, especially now that we know how you got that name, Jonathan. Is music important to you? Because it sounds you speak passionately about the pieces you've spoken, chosen, but is it important to you?
Music is so important to me that it was really difficult, I have to say this, Rodney. Very, very, very difficult to come up with a short list. Even my short list is too long. Because
it is,
each
yes.
of the music is something I'm passionate about.
Do you listen a lot to relax?
I listen a lot. I listen to a lot of news and all sorts of things. But in between, I listen to music. I love jazz. I love classical. I sometimes even listen to opera. I listen to popular music now. I've listened to world music, as they call it, African music. I've got quite a wide.
Have you ever played an instrument, or are you just a passionate listener?
Well, I started playing a T-box bass. You know that
that yes,
thing
I
that
exactly
you,
you,
know,
you,
you you make a hole in an old fashioned T-box and you put the rope in the top and the broomstick and you stand on top of it. It's really funny. It's kind of cartoonish. I kind of fitted my persona that was starting to develop in the 70s, I suppose. And I played that I jammed with people who could play properly, and it was fun. So I tried to take up the double bass, but I was studying architecture, and it was just too much. I couldn't keep up the practicing, so I played it about 6 months. I've still got it. It's an absolutely gorgeous instrument. It's now just a decoration. But I also sang close harmony.
Yes.
I sang in choirs and things, and then gradually sang in close harmony. Actually, one of the nicest things about that was that I ended up singing in a Robert Kirby show at the Baxter.
My goodness.
One of his satirical reviews.
Yes.
And it was a little group called the Moron Tabernacle Choir, which was fantastic. I sang for about just over a week in that show when somebody left the show. And I did an audition for it, and I had the bass voice that they wanted, and I could hold the tune. And I also play the chromatic harmonica. I've just taught myself that, which I love. So
Music is there.
Music's there, and jazz in particular.
when you spoke about Zapiro and at school and drawing, getting into trouble, drawing the principal. So this thing of drawing and cartoons goes back to your very young days.
Oh yeah, I mentioned the Giles books. The that was probably my first real influence. After that was Tintin. Like a lot of kids, I was absolutely enthralled by those books. I only realized many years later that there's all kinds of interesting politics around that. I mean, he moved from being quite almost supporting fascists, or at least working for fascists, and that, and doing things that were quite transgressive, very viciously anti-left, anti-communist, whatever, and also very racist. His 1931 book, Tintin in the Congo. But he changed a lot. He actually nearly got cancelled at the end of the war for quite unusual. I can't even go into the reasons. But he changed a lot after he became a humanist. Anyway, I love his work. And
he drew himself, did he? Did he draw those cartoons himself?
Yes, he did. Later he had a number of assistants who were drawing. It was such an exercise to draw Tintin books. He had people who were specialists in machinery and people who were specialists in various other things helping him in his studio. I actually later visited the studio in 1981. Wow. When I was a student and trying to change from architecture. And I missed him by a day. He'd been there the previous day. He was not that well, and he died a couple of years later. But he was a huge influence.
But you said also Asterix was a bit of an influence.
Yes, Asterix. I mean, the drawings of Asterix I absolutely loved, and the writing. Mm-hmm. Two different people, because the one was Uderzo, the artist, and the writer was Goscinny. I always wished that Uderzo had not carried on the books without a writer after Goscinny died. So the first 23 books or something are brilliant. After that, the drawings are great, but not the stories. Uderzo was a genius as an artist. And on that same trip, as I went to meet Hergé, I actually did get to meet Uderzo in Paris. And I got lost in Paris looking for his studio. And then it got really late. And then I realized his apartment wasn't very far away. So by the time I arrived there, it was 5 to 11 at night.
Oh, dear.
In autumn. So I have told the story many times, but it was the terror of holding my finger at that doorbell for 5 minutes and pressing the doorbell at 11 o'clock, and then he's actually inviting me in, and not being able to speak English, and then luckily getting someone to translate, his daughter. I never forgot that. He was a very generous story. Thing to do, and he gave me a lot of encouragement. He saw my drawings, and yeah.
And I just want you to tell me what you think of my favorite cartoon strip, which is Peanuts.
Absolutely one of my top ever.
Oh, good. So and you can stay.
after Giles and Tintin, my next thing, I became, passing myself off as the biggest Peanuts fan in the world. I would cut everything out that I could see, and I collected everything. I was a complete fanatic of Peanuts. So I totally agree with you. He's a philosopher, absolute genius as a comic strip artist, and the progenitor of people like Calvin and Hobbes, which is the equivalent, an even better artist than Charles Schulz, and on the same level intellectually.
Let's have another music break now, Jonathan, and I see you've chosen the great Abdullah Ibrahim.
Mm.
And Water from an Ancient Well, is there a story around this one?
The story around Abdullah is not so much around this particular song. I just absolutely love it. It's one of my, three, four, five, I don't know, best Abdullah numbers. And it's more recent than when I was first exposed to Abdullah's music, when he was still Dollar Brand. Mm-hmm. And I was studying at Cape Town University at UCT, and I was doing architecture, but my head wasn't really in it. I was starting to kind of get a political sensibility a little bit, and I understood that that he had left, and I was starting to pick up what the exiles were and who they were, and I've just completely loved his music and the Cape influences, and the kind of guma that he would weave into his music. It's heartrending kind of pathos that was there, that I really felt it. It was at the time, I remember walking through District 6, we were doing a little student movie through these deserted places. We set ourselves up as on the corner playing jazz. Some of the people were actually playing. I was kind of pretending on the double
miming.
Bass. Yes. Yeah. So that's all that kind of Cape Town history and pathos is woven into his. And then, of course, as I was leaving to go and study in New York in 1988, flew to England and then flew across to New York and went, I had just come out of detention. I was in detention without trial in 1988 and nearly didn't make it onto my trip to New York. So, the world was opening up in a very real way to us. We'd been very, very in the dark in South Africa in so many ways, and the cultural boycotts and all that. And there was a concert by Abdullah in a small venue. I think it was Hammersmith. And we got in early, so I was right at his feet. And I felt like I was at the feet of the master. And we'd bought a little plate of something to eat earlier. And I just thought, I can see this profile. I've got to draw. So all I had was this round, slightly waxy cardboard plate. And I drew this caricature of him as he was playing the piano. And I'm still very proud of it. It turned out really well. And I like the fact that it's on this little cardboard
plate. Have you still got it?
Plate. Yes, I have. Okay. Yeah.
Has it been out? Has it been published? Has it been out?
No. Those kind of things, I do want to publish some of those things with little stories and whatever. Right. Maybe in the next couple of years I'll do a book like that.
Let's listen to Abdullah Ibrahim. Thank you. There we are. Abdullah Ibrahim, that piece was called Water from an Ancient Well. And it was the second choice of my guest on People of Note this week, brought to you by Peter Turin Productions, here on Fine Music Radio, Jonathan Shapiro. So as I said, Jonathan, I'm hovering here between Jonathan and Shapiro. But you've spoken a few times about going to New York, but you've also said that you tried to get out of architecture, and you've made it sound as though it was quite difficult. And there were years then when things in this country were really, really bad.
I was studying architecture, which at that stage was a six-year degree. But I really wanted to be a cartoonist. And as I realized that more and more definitely, after traveling overseas on my architectural fourth year, I came back and I said to my parents, I know it's, you know, you've been paying for my studies. I mean, I was earning a little bit here and there. And I said, but would you mind if I changed to graphic design to try and become a cartoonist? And they said, they were very supportive. I tried. And the army immediately sent me a letter saying, you're not going to get deferment. Now, that was my worst nightmare because many of us, you know, young white males, didn't want to go to the army, some of us. And I certainly didn't. And I fought them for ages. I started doing graphic design. I was doing really well for a change. I used to do well at school, and then I didn't do that well in architecture. Then I was doing really well. But they pulled me out after my first semester, and I had 3 weeks to decide what the heck to do. I just didn't know what to do. It was 6 years jail if you refused, and I didn't know if I could leave the country. I went into the army, and I refused to carry a gun. And they, after a lot of many hard weeks where I was the kind of the real victim of abuse of a kind by the corporals and lieutenants and whatever, and out of 700, I was the sort of main target. They gave me a lead pole to carry. It was a ridiculous little thing, and it made me into a bit of a joke, which was fine by me. And it was part of that persona that I really felt now suddenly I wanted to be an activist. But I was in this damn army. So carrying this pole, a corporal even made me stand guard with it, which was very funny. He got into big trouble. And then during the time I was in the army, the United Democratic Front formed. And by that time, I had got myself down to Cape Town. And so I couldn't do duties where, you know, standing guard anymore. And they weren't that stupid to keep on making me stand guard. So I had time to go and be an activist in the UDF. And I very quickly got arrested, which freaked the army out because I was still in the army. And then I remember the first time I got arrested, Trevor Manuel came to bail me and the rest of the activists out. We were held at Athlone Police Station. This was the start of years of activism for UDF and for the end conscription campaign. I actually designed the ECC logo while I was still in the army. Yeah. And then for the next, you know, 6-7 years, that was my main thing. I was working for organizations until I eventually got the chance. Well, then I was detained without trial in 88 by the security police.
For how long?
Well, you never know how long it's going to be.
No.
And they put me, after I refused to answer questions, they put me in solitary. I was in solitary for 5 days, and then they put me back into the section with other activists. I was there for another 6 days. They thought I was on the Nelson Mandela birthday committee, which I wasn't, but there was, funnily enough, there was another guy called Jonathan Shapiro, and they mixed the two of us up.
Okay.
They later mixed the two of us up again. They detained him because they thought he was me after I left to study. So it was a comedy of errors, but also incredibly energizing time.
Mm-hmm, I'm sure. And did you then, were you drawing at this stage, during this energizing time?
Yes, yes. By that time, I decided when I got out of the army in the middle of 84, by that time, I there was no way I was going to go back and study. I was just working almost full-time for organizations, earning a little pittance every now and then, doing kind of commissions for the paying work. And that was my life. An amazing time it was, actually.
Yeah. Sort of an impression on your life that
hugely,
it was made,
yeah,
hugely.
Yeah.
But then how did you get to New York?
Oh, well, in 1987, I applied for a Fulbright scholarship because I felt like my interrupted graphic studies, you know, could be continued somewhere else. And I felt a little burnt out as well after, you know, this 6-7 years. There was no end in sight to the struggle, and we didn't expect things to happen. You know, no one expected it to happen in 1990. Mm-hmm. But as I went to study in New York at the School of Visual Arts, I got this, what I called a half-bright. I hope the Fulbright, you know, they know how grateful I am. It was, they phoned me up and they said, would you like, we don't think you need a degree, but how would you feel about a year of non-degree study at the school of your choice? And I said, I'll take that, thank you. And off I went to the School of Visual Arts, which was phenomenal. And also they liked what I was doing and they gave me a second year free. The school gave me a tuition waiver. So I had this phenomenal situation of having 2 years of free study or doing all subjects of my choice at the School of Visual Arts is a fantastic media school. I also had an independent study under Art Spiegelman. So it was an amazing time as well, and a time of exploring the world. And exploring New York was so cosmopolitan. We had friends from all over the world, and that's when we listened to this this band called Le Negres Vert.
And you've chosen that now as a piece, haven't you?
Yes, they were, you know, French, but they had the sort of Romani influence and the kind of North African Arabic influence, and they were just vibey and wonderful. So that was our sort of band of choice.
How do you pronounce the name of that group, Jonathan? Le Negres Vert.
Le Negres Vert. I have no idea. My French is terrible. So.
Well, it was another choice of my guest on People of Note this week, Zapiro, the cartoonist, whose new book, his 27th annual collection, is on sale now in bookshops. But I wanted to, we've spoken a lot about your background and the interesting life you've had, but I want to know a little bit about your style. We spoke about Peanuts and we spoke about Tintin. All of them seem to have a character. You don't have a character, do you? Your cartoons are on their own. There's no person that appears in your cartoons all the time,
no.
Apart from our politicians.
The politicians and occasionally sort of self-referential stuff where I insert myself commenting on.
Yes.
But now it's a very different sort of genre, really. The comic strips that were very influential for me when I was young are very different from the editorial cartoons. Actually, the first editorial cartoonist, well, other than Giles, kind of light satire, which I was influenced by when I was young, but the first local cartoonist is really under-celebrated in South Africa, and he was around in Cape Town, David Marais. He was at the Cape Times from the 50s through to the early 70s. And what a genius. I mean, he wasn't the best draftsman around. There were others who were better, even John Jackson at the Argus at the time. But John Jackson was as wonderful a draftsman as he was. He was quite reactionary. So I was influenced by David Maria's head and his progressive politics and his journalist's training. And I always loved the idea of being a kind of a journalistic cartoonist. Not that I didn't study journalism, I didn't study art, until later. Mm-hmm. I didn't study history or politics or economics or anything. I didn't study pretty much anything that would give me the right to be a cartoonist. But it's one of those things that I just felt.
You did it.
But yeah, so he was an influence on me, certainly cerebrally, David Marais. And then I would say the English vicious satirical cartoonists, Ralph Steadman and Gerald Scarfe. That was a kind of a 70s thing that they were both absolute geniuses who started off fairly together and eventually ended up hating each other, I gather. Mm-hmm. I don't know if there's been any reconciliation, but they were both geniuses. If I had to pick one, I'd say I prefer Ralph Steadman. And he was a huge influence on Derek Bauer locally. Now, Derek, again, also I felt the stylistic influence, but not a political influence. Mm-hmm. Derek was a bit of an anarchist, and I was much more left-wing inclined.
Right.
Those comic strips were hugely influential. So I kind of, then when I studied in America, I started pulling in some of the very clear communication of the American style of editorial cartooning and comics. So it's a sort of a mix that gradually takes shape.
You were famously the one who put the shower head on Zuma's head, didn't you?
Yes,
you still do it, I see.
I still do it. I started that in 2006 during his rape trial.
But now, as I've said, and you say here, every time I think things cannot get any weirder, they go and get twice as weird. Not even my crazy mind, you say, could invent a country where, at the same time, we have the devastating final Zonda report delivered too late, two Gupta brothers finally arrested, and a brazenly crooked ex-spy chief revealing that millions of dollars in cash has been stolen from Cyril's game farm. So every day, I remember Peter Dirk Ace used to say that to me. He said he never has to worry about material. Yeah. Well, how does it work? What is your deadline, or when do you have to sit down and think, or how does each cartoon come about? Briefly.
Briefly. You have to rein me in here.
Yes,
The process is a little bit open-ended at the beginning because it's listening, it is trawling through sites, it's reading. I still have old-fashioned newspapers, a few of them around. They're not that many good ones. The Daily Maverick puts out a great newspaper Saturday.
Yes, absolutely.
The 168. And I'm with Daily Maverick now.
Yes.
But I've been over the years with a number of newspapers when some of them were still very good. So it's difficult. I start playing around with different subjects, and suddenly the links happen that you don't expect, because humor and satire, both, and they obviously connected. Not everything satirical has to be funny, but they are connected by surprise.
Mm.
So you're trying to make links that are not necessarily there when you first when you first go for it, let alone the reader.
Yes.
You want there to be that surprise which either shocks you or makes you laugh or makes you just think.
But you've shocked people many times, back to the Zuma rape thing with
the Statue of Justice, the figure of justice.
Yeah, figure of justice. Yes. But also one of your very latest ones now with this whole Qatar thing is that one where there's someone lifting the pitch and sweeping dead bodies underneath.
Yes, so the migrant, about 6,000 migrant workers have died during the years of putting this Qatar soccer extravaganza together. And it is, look, it's not the first World Cup of soccer or World Cup of other things or the Olympics that's gone to a country that has a bad human rights record. I remember in China 2008 or whatever, Russia, there've been others. But this one, it just felt like it's just wrong in every respect. It's environmentally wrong. It's not a soccer country. It's that the alcohol thing is. But then the real terrible stuff is the killing of them. The how many migrant workers have their rights have been totally ignored and they've died in construction and whatever. And they just it's just lit. I felt that very much. They're being papered over.
Yeah.
And the LGBTQI plus, they all of that. That's also a major issue, you know, not nearly as many deaths. I'm sure there are some people who died, but not nearly, but the trampling of the human rights of everyone in that community is also really worrying.
Jonathan, briefly, have any of your cartoons been banned by the newspaper? The editor saying, no, too far. No,
when I said my immediate yes was banned by the apartheid government banned a series of my cartoons had been banned. The very first cartoon I did for the United Democratic Front was banned. A calendar poster that I did in 1986, 487, which was one of the best pieces of work I've ever done, was banned. And it was also, there are many stories around that. Editors have, it's a different thing. You didn't say banned, but they have pulled cartoons at the last minute. There have been some. Usually I try and have a relationship with the editor so we discuss things and see. But every now and then there'd been an issue or an editor that I don't get on with as well. And not that many of them. But I've had issues. I got once suspended for a week by an editor who didn't like something that I was saying about Mbeki's AIDS denialism. Things like that have happened. That's sort of par for the course for a cartoon, as you do push the boundaries.
All right, well, let's pause now for some music. Harry Belafonte, I'm glad you've chosen him. But you say there's a story here as well.
Yeah, you know, there are so many things that happen to me that I could not have possibly foreseen. It's just been a roller coaster. The Harry Belafonte thing was like that because in 2001, it was Christmas Day. I get a phone call from a guy with an American accent. He said, hello, would you like to meet Harry Belafonte? And I said, certainly I would. Who is this? He said, well, I'm his agent, and he'd very much like to meet you. So I was speechless, which is unusual for me. And
yes,
then,
so I noticed.
And I said, well, where? He said, well, where do you live? I told him where I lived, and I said, when? So he said, well, how's this evening? So I said, great. So I go off to the beach. It's the middle of summer, and I come back from the beach, and I sort of get myself all set up in the studio. The gate bell rings, and I see this enormous, compared to me, enormous. He's tall, very good-looking, as an elderly man, but absolutely amazing-looking, still in this huge coat on our South African summer day. It was very strange. And I spring the bell, he walks in and he gives me this huge bear hug and really happy to meet me. We go and sit down and I start talking with him, and I'm still figuring out why he wanted to come. How does this happen? And he says, we talk for a minute or two, and he says, hang on, there's something I want to say. And he says, I was expecting a black man. He says, God has a sense of humor.
That is a very funny
story, isn't it? And I actually asked him, well, why? And I said, and I also asked him later, can I put that on the back of one of my books, which he very kindly gave me permission to do, Harry Belafonte on Meetings Appear. So, but the thing was, he had seen a cartoon that I had done during South Africa's United Nations anti-racism conference a couple of months earlier. I'd done a cartoon that was that really sort of took apart the sort of politics of African America set up against the American establishment, because of course Colin Powell was the Secretary of State, an African American, and he had wanted to come to this conference. George W. Bush had said, okay, you can go, and then he turned around and said you couldn't. So I did a sort of a freed slave thing with Colin Powell. And they're saying to Colin, the other slaves are saying to Colin Powell as they go off to the racism conference with their little packs on their backs. And they say, coming, Uncle Tom. And he said, the master in the big house says I ain't. And and that, he thought, this had to be a black cartoonist. And it, and he was really surprised. And we had this fantastic rapport and an unbelievable meeting. And that's one of the most incredible things that's ever happened to me as a cartoonist.
He's going to sing Midnight Special, Harry Belafonte.
I wake up in the morning, hear the ding-dong ring. You go a-marching to the table, you see the same old thing. Baby, all I wanna tell you, a knife, a fork, and a pan. And if you say a thing about it, you're in trouble with the man. Let the midnight special shine a light on me. Let the midnight special shine its ever-loving light on me. Yes, let the midnight special shine a light on me. Let the midnight special shine its ever-loving light on me. If you ever go to Houston, then you better walk or ride. You better not stagger, and you better not fight. 'Cause Sheriff Benson will arrest you, he'll carry you on down. And if the jury finds you guilty, you're penitentiary bound. So let the midnight special shine a light on me. Let the midnight special shine its ever-loving light on me. Yonder comes Miss Rosie. How I wonder, did you know? How well I know her by apron and the dress she wore. Umbrella on her shoulder, piece of paper in her hand. She goes a-walking to the captain, says I'm losing my man. So let the midnight special shine its light on me. Let the midnight special shine its ever-loving light on me. Let the midnight special shine its light on me. Let that midnight special shine its ever-loving light on me. Let the midnight special shine its light on me. I'ma let that special shine its ever-loving light on me.
Harry Belafonte there with Midnight Special after that lovely story from my guest, Zapiro, Jonathan Shapiro. Jonathan, you know, just before we end, and time has rushed by, as you can see, I often think with someone like a cartoonist or a comedian, there must be times when you have upheavals in your life and all that, and yet you've got to make people laugh. You've got to get up in the morning, and if anything has happened to you, kind of make people laugh. Is that tricky? Has that happened to you?
Yes, and people who know me, I feel like I've had a pretty much a charmed life for a long, long time. In the last couple of years, I've had real difficult upheaval, and I hope that people aren't able to see that in the cartoons, because I've really worked hard at trying to keep that separate from whatever happens in my private life. And I've really enjoyed that as my cartoons as an outlet. Mm-hmm. But, as things have started to kind of improve a bit, somebody sent me a wonderful piece of music, which I absolutely love, and which is kind of, I'm kind of looking to the future with this. It's the best piece of new jazz that I've heard in a long time. And so the music is that also that outlet, and my cartoons and music and kind of walking on the mountain. Those are my...
Okay. Yeah. Jonathan, we have to end, but before, I just want to say that you're doing some appearances here in Cape Town for your new annual, which is out now. 11 o'clock at Exclusive Books in Constantia Village on the 3rd of December, and also at Exclusive Books at 1:30 at Cavendish Square. And Exclusive Books at the V&A Waterfront on the 4th, as well as at the Somerset Mall on the 4th, and also in Hermanus, the Bookmark, on the 17th of December. So make a note of those dates, and you can go along and meet Jonathan. And if you're lucky, he will sign your book as he signed mine.
Yeah, of course I'll sign. And I speak to people. I love meeting people when I'm out there. Good. Actually have incredible experiences doing that.
Excellent. Jonathan, it's been amazing speaking to you, Zapiro. And... best of luck, and I look forward to paging through your annual, and I'll see you next time.
Great. Thanks, Rodney.
Well, let's listen now to Hide and Seek with Joshua Redman. Thank you. People of Note on Fine Music Radio was proudly brought to you by Peter Turin Productions. FMR.